Hello, this is David Rovics, hosting another live stream broadcast, which is appearing on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and various other platforms. During the pandemic, since I can no longer tour and play music for a living, I've taken to broadcasting most every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT. On Mondays, it's an open mic, which I call Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which folks are encouraged to sign up to participate in at davidrovics.com/POMM. Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, I've been interviewing my friends for the most part and sort of publicly catching up with people who I might otherwise be hanging out with physically on a typical tour if such things were still happening. On Tuesdays, however, the broadcast has an actual producer, longtime Detroit area talk show host and Fifth Estate magazine editorial collective member, Peter Werby. These days, Fifth Estate is a quarterly print magazine that has been published in one form or another since its founding in 1965. You can read the entirety of the spring issue online at fifthestate.org. You can also subscribe to the print magazine there and hear previous episodes of Fifth Estate Live as well. Today, we're talking with John Zerzan, philosopher, historian, author of many books and essays, and a regular contributor to the Fifth Estate since the 1970s. In certain circles of society, everyone seems to have an opinion about him, whether they've read any of his stuff or not. But whether you like to read or not, you can also listen to him every Tuesday on local radio in Eugene as the host of Anarchy Radio on KWVA. All the episodes are also archived on his website, johnzerzan.net. John Zerzan, glad to have you here on Fifth Estate Live. John, on a recent, I think it was the last of your radio shows that's available on the website, you mentioned something that I just keep on thinking about for months now, about all the chickens that are coming home to roost, to use a certain phrase, right now. And which is kind of why I started doing interviews, was because there's so many chickens coming home to roost. It's just really too hard to even keep track of them. And I wonder if you could just give us your take on which are the biggest chickens roosting at the moment.
Well, the most obvious one, I guess, is the pandemic. And we're clearly in the age of pandemics. Today in the New York Times, I'm reading that bubonic plague struck a herder in Mongolia. Within the week, H1N1, a new strain of H1N1, is breaking out in China. And Ebola, about 10 days ago, they announced the end of the Ebola outbreak. Same day, they had to announce the beginning of a new one. So, you know, this is a global thing, the sickness of late civilization, literally the pathology of it all. And that's just one of the more obvious ones. What's happening to the physical environment, catastrophic, that's coming home to roost with a vengeance. There's, you know, 100 different things. I don't have to retail them here for you, but, you know, the oceans are rising, warming, acidifying, filling with plastics, you know, on and on and on, the enormous extinction rate, actually, the bigger pandemic, by the way, is air pollution pandemic, kills a lot more people than the pandemic is likely to kill, not to discount that, but the air on the planet, you know, that's just incredible. For example, I was remembering last summer, the air in London was often worse than in Beijing. So you can't just, you know, write it off as some part of the world. That's just a big, huge reality. And, you know, the social fabric, let's take a look at the social fabric, especially here in America. You know, it's amazing how much anxiety, depression, suicides, mass shootings. I mean, the whole thing is so scary. It's just the backdrop of everyday life, of social existence. It's just becoming more tattered all the time. And of course, all these things are tied together. That's the totality is, you can't really pick up one without noticing the links throughout, you know, the way all of this is interdependent.
It's, I mean, when if you just read any news report of some kind of global recap of what's been going on over the past few days, and I mean, this has been true for a long time, but it just sounds so biblical, kind of like, you know, floods, famines, plagues. I mean, we're in this age of pandemics. You call as you refer to it as the age of pandemics, age of extinction. It's pretty bleak stuff overall, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know this is the sort of question that typically interviewers like to ask at the very end, but you write about how much more depression and anxiety and there is in society, and this is something that is being talked about in mainstream circles now. I mean, a lot of the things actually that you've been writing about for a long time are now being talked about in mainstream circles. I don't know if this is something you're noticing over the past few weeks, but it's like the whole conversation is changing in a lot of ways, would you say? I mean, it's kind of interesting.
Well, yeah, I find that pretty hopeful, or at least signs of that. Not as much as one would like, but yeah, that is coming to pass. For example, the future of cities, the nature of cities is on offer really due to the pandemic, because it's all about density, and it has been since domestication. That's what domestication is, and that's why infectious disease starts with domestication/civilization. So you start seeing, some people anyway, are seeing the depths of this crisis, you know, and the roots of it. And, you know, I guess I'm noticing in particular in the anti-authoritarian milieu, more zines that are pretty specifically anti-civilization, green anarchy, if you will. And for example, in the past few days, there was a note about a new one from Ireland. And this is the second one in Ireland, by the way, that's green anarchy oriented. En Real, I'm probably horribly mispronouncing it, but you know, these things are popping up in our own circles, and that's it's about time that the red anarchism got out of the picture and out of the way. For example, the rollout here with this new zine that I mentioned here from Ireland. There's a poster as part of the rollout, and it says, "Whose streets? No streets." You know, terra rolled concrete. In other words, there's the difference right there. Not that these other struggles aren't important, but, you know, what is more basic? Are cities viable? Do they have a future? Of course not. But so now we're getting to that place, I guess, slowly anyway.
That is one. I mean, as a songwriter, that's a wonderful slogan. I'm going to have to do something with "Whose streets, no streets," and "Whose streets, our streets." Is a wonderful sort of comparison between the two concepts. But at the same time, like another thing that is being a lot of people are widely criticizing the capitalist system specifically as a form of industrial society that is particularly incapable of meeting the current moment, whereas other societies that are less dominated by corporations seem to be at least somewhat more capable of dealing with the pandemic anyway, and sort of keeping people housed and fed while they're quarantined, for example. I don't know where this is going necessarily, but I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that in terms of the different kinds of industrial societies that are currently being questioned right now.
Well, yeah, there are differences. And, you know, sometimes we, to use the word we, are criticized for not talking about capitalism enough. But I think that's, there's not much more to be said about capitalism. I mean, it's kind of obvious. And that is certainly... you know, that's problematic, obviously. That's just another phase of capitalism. And I don't think the differences should be exaggerated, though, by the way. I mean, you could easily have a socialist government that has no problem at all with civilization or industrialism or domestication, and they're fine with streets, you know. But yeah, it's not that there are no distinctions. You know, there certainly are.
I wonder if, do you have any thoughts on the global happiness index that comes out every year? Because, I mean, you write about the social alienation of people in modern society and many other societies going thousands of years. But every year, this the global happiness index comes out. You know, they study people and however they do it in 156 countries. And it's always several Scandinavian countries at the top. And I don't know if this is... any thoughts on that? Is that something you've paid attention to?
Well, you know, I'm kind of confused by that. It always strikes me that one can be personally happy. For example, I'm personally happy, but you know, I'm not in the dark as to how horrendous things are. You know, at large, macroscopically. I mean, in other words, those are two different things, and it's really hard to get much out of that, it seems to me. I'm a fairly happy, optimistic, satisfied person, but that doesn't mean that, you know, again, that I don't see the horrible reality out there. I mean, so what can you make of that? Whether, you know, in terms of one's subjective feelings and the rest of it is two different things.
It's more about perception or how people perceive their lives to be according to this, which then begs the question, what do they imagine life? Are they imagining how life could be so different than it is? Or because, I mean, I don't know, I spend a lot of time in Scandinavia as a touring performer. And, you know, the idea that it's a happy society, well, yeah, compared to many other societies, that kind of, I can see that compared to societies where there's a lot more poverty and hunger and that sort of thing. But at the same time, it strikes me that most people in Scandinavia, just like most people here, spend a lot of their time being really lonely and alienated from humanity and staring at screens and not particularly happy, but I guess it's all relative.
Huh? Well, yeah. And it's how you phrase the question too. I mean, it's possible to sort these things out, and yeah, there's alcoholism and suicide and so forth. I mean, I'm not Alice's people are Norwegian, so I've been there a little bit. And but yeah, as you say, it's very different there. I mean, they do have certainly much more of a social net than some other countries, exceedingly more than some other countries. But on the regular day to day life thing, it's I think you're right. It's not that much different.
Avi, just as a little aside, since you mentioned Alice in Norway, do you have much connection with the Czech Republic? Both your parents are of Czech extraction, is that right?
Yeah. No, I don't. We were in Brno, where Freddie Perlman was born 2-3 years ago, and it was very cool. It's a film festival thing, and but no, I'm both sides of the family. One is Moravian and the other is Bohemian, but you know, those are the two parts that make up what's now called the Czech Republic. But I don't have any real context there, no.
There's one of the folks viewing this conversation on KBOO's Facebook page, who runs KBOO's social media operation, mentions that is basically thanking you for writing about the calendar and various other things. But I wonder if you could talk about time and what the role of time and timekeeping has been in terms of further oppressing humanity. It's a big question, but I know it's one you've written about a lot.
Yeah, it's always intrigued me. I always think of that quote from Augustine. Well, I know perfectly well what time is, unless somebody asks me what it is. I mean, it's the materiality of it. It's the when time turned into a thing, and you can just chart this not only industrial time, but I mean, all the way back, I guess, really, you can. It's just another way of measuring alienation. I think it's maybe that's a crude way to put it, but it always occurs to me. I always run into that. The time consciousness is pretty much a measure of estrangement, of alienation. And we don't know that, you know, at some point hunter-gatherers had zero sense of time, it wasn't a symbolic dimension. It wasn't a concept. It wasn't a reality, however you want to put it. But I think that's, you know, from the anthropology, it's pretty clear that relatively that's so. Now, of course, time stands over us as a thing. It's what could be more obvious. It just, you know, it's an oppressive force that rules us, and more and more and more. It's just a function of the movement of the whole thing. And it breaks out more and more as it progresses. You know, it becomes more and more intrusive and determining. You know, It's maybe the first symbolic dimension of all. You know, when that starts to enter the picture, we're removed from immediacy insofar as we have that sense of time. Hard to get away from it now. You know, I used to work in the fields as a kid during the summers, and we were fairly near this installation that had a steam whistle at noon when we could knock off and have lunch. And as a kid, I found myself able to guess when the whistle was going to blow within seconds. I was so trained, so conditioned by it. And I thought, wow, how wonderful, how cool I am. And then, of course, later I thought, man, what a complete hostage to time. If you're that calibrated by it, it's crazy.
It is. I've since the pandemic hit, and I've become even more of a news junkie than I was before. I actually wake up on the hour at 5 o'clock every morning. Mm-hmm. Because I want to hear the headlines. It's just it's a bizarre reality, but
yeah.
my mind knows what time it is.
Right. You know, nobody can step outside of it. I mean, unless the total culture is transformed, that would be the only way to get out of it. Otherwise, or you can, you know, zone out or whatever, but it's there.
It's there. There was this something I read recently. I guess I don't know how much of the archaeological, it sounds like from reading 1491, this book by Charles Mann, it sounded like there's been a lot of archaeological stuff that has been learned by archaeologists over the past few decades using soil analysis techniques that apparently didn't exist before. I'm just repeating what he said. I have no idea. But one of the things that they said they know now is that 12,000 years ago, the human brain was 15% bigger than it is now. And that's just so striking in your broad take on the history of the past 12,000 years or so of parts of the world, and ultimately most of the world becoming agricultural civilizations and all this, has it been a downward trend, things moving in the wrong direction consistently, or has it been more of a roller coaster?
Well, you see, what gets it going is domestication, the massive epical shift from hunter-gatherer life to that of domesticators. It all changed almost overnight after, you know, we were likely cooking with fire 2 million years ago, and yet it was only, you know, like you say, 10,000 years ago or less that it all changed and introduced all of the problems, all of the, you know, war, cities, you know, the whole shebang, the tendency toward the religious escape, and, you know, a million other things that did not exist before that. You know, you think of the pandemic. Well, for instance, it makes me think that, or it reminds me that infectious disease and degenerative disease, that was brought about by domestication. Neither existed before that. That's kind of staggering.
Yeah.
You mentioned the brain. Well, Neanderthal brain was much bigger than ours, much bigger than Homo sapiens. That in itself doesn't necessarily tell you a lot, but I mean, what I go back to all the time is the capacities. We find this more and more in the literature, how much how capable people were at earlier and earlier ages. I mean, it's just kind of remarkable. Well before the symbolic, well before symbolic culture. No trace of symbolic culture past maybe 30,000 years ago or something like that. But, you know, living in band society and face-to-face society without domestication, you know, in a state of eros and freedom and so on. I mean, it's kind of amazing. It's the way to kind of undo all this thinking, you know, all the sort of comic book figures about, you know, brawny, stupid people dragging the woman into the cave and dying by age of 25, all these nonsense things that are just really comic book ideas. And yet, you know, when you take a look at it, it wasn't like that at all, as far as we know. I mean, the evidence points in the opposite direction. Like, for example, just one instance, in Germany, they found these fossilized hunting spears, wooden spears, very long, heavy spears. Usually never find that, you know, it's petrified wood is what it is. And unlike stone tools, it doesn't last very long. You're not going to find other kinds of tools from horn or from wood or from very likely, and you know, it all disappears. Well, these hunting spears were perfectly balanced, you know, just remarkably so. I mean, they weren't just some sticks that somebody was going to pick up and toss. No, they were the heft of it, the balance of it. You know, that was a conscious thing. I mean, that took some brain power 400,000 years ago. Wow. And probably earlier than that.
Anyway, 400,000 years ago. 400,000. So that's before Homo sapiens were in Europe, right?
Oh, yeah. Well before.
Yeah.
Still have Homo erectus and other Homo species. But, but they knew how to do all these things. And maybe, you know, gives pause to when we think about how wonderful we are, how smart we are. It's, you know, we're so de-skilled now. That's just a remarkable fact. We can do things on a screen or something, but you know, what happens when we're going to have to do something in reality? You know, it's all these skills that we've lost that we've just been pitching aside.
It's like, I mean, it's one thing to have the knowledge of like the Encyclopedia Britannica in terms of local herbs. Like they say, the average person in the indigenous person in the Amazon if their knowledge of herbs and plants were written out, it would take volumes and volumes. But like, there's also, just in my own lived experience, I feel my brain deteriorating. Like physically, like it's almost like I'm sure if it were measured, it would be smaller than it was 20 years ago. Cause I'm completely dependent on GPSs. I have no ability to find my way anywhere. Although I love the fact that I don't, you know, as a touring musician, I no longer spend about 4 hours every week hopelessly lost in some city I've never been to, incredibly frustrated. I don't miss that at all. But my brain is, I mean, my ability to find my way out of a paper bag is seriously hindered now, and I'm totally GPS dependent. And the same thing happens with memory. Like now I can have lyrics on an iPad. I can do a song that I just wrote last week much more easily without having to remember it. But then I start forgetting a lot of other things. And then when the printing press came around, 500 or whenever years ago became popular, that must have had such an impact on the oral tradition. I went, you know, so many of these things, they're just spun in this positive way, but I'm not sure, you know, they're mostly negative, it seems. I wonder if maybe even including the printing press.
Oh, agreed. Yeah. These dependencies, they narrow our life. And now, you know, direct experience itself is going away. It just is. It's all mediated. It's all on the screen. It's all these different ways that we live in this synthetic zone. And it's just, and it just goes step by step. I mean, it didn't happen overnight. As you point out, you can go well back. And Plato pointed out, writing is going to take away memory because we won't need it. We'll just write it down and then, you know, apply to it later. But yeah, all these things, they just narrow life. They don't expand it. And now, of course, you have the claims and promises of technology writ large from all sides every day, how we're much more connected all the time, which is a fabulous lie. We've never been so isolated and disconnected. The machines are connected, but are we really connected? Or, you know, are we more empowered? Well, of course, we're so disempowered, it's pathetic. And, you know, all these mammoth lies that, you know, the wonders of technology, it's going to just keep getting better and better. People are less and less healthy. Gee, I thought, anywhere you look, it's just the opposite virtually of all of these things that are said. But if you bombard people enough and are already dependent on the whole thing and devices and, you know, staring at the screen all day, I mean, you know, then they're more prey to just keep going after that. You know, well, I guess I got to get a new this and that. And, you know, that's the world, you know, that's reality. And that's how it's defined. And, you know, it's pretty amazing.
There's always some kind of thing that attracts people to the idea, and then the actual reality is very much different from what attracted them to it in the first place. I mean, it's partly the situation with the pandemic, especially, and all this use of these supposedly connected technologies becoming so much more popular than they were even a few months ago. And like, I've interviewed a couple of people who, you know, the benefits of being a Pan-Africanist and not having to travel to Tanzania to have a meeting with folks from Ghana, the US, and Britain, you know, that's kind of obvious. It's maybe nicer to have it on Zoom, but that you lose so much in the process.
Huh? Yeah, and there's a lot of specific things. I'm just thinking of one in particular. Through the internet, all these social movements and stuff like Arab Spring, man, you could do all kinds of stuff, organize all these activities and make it happen. Well, it turns out that's not the way it works.
No.
Certainly you can share information. We all do that. I mean, there's got to be something worthwhile in it, or nobody would bother with it at all. But, you know, in other words, it's a very thin connection. It doesn't cause people to do things like get out in the streets and confront the cops or something. That's just not... it doesn't do that. It just doesn't. And then now you read these studies after the fact, and wow, I guess it wasn't quite that simple, that more technology means more movement. No, it's been the opposite. People are more, you know, they do less because it's all virtual anyway. You know, you don't have to go there. As you say, you don't have to go to Africa. You can just, or you can have a virtual petition or some crap like that, as if that makes any difference. You know, just a lot of hot air, which is, you know, pumped at people all the time. So, of course, it has an impact.
Yeah. You're listening to Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio. You can find all the episodes archived in audio form at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the Fifth Estate print magazine. We're talking with philosopher and historian from Eugene, Oregon, John Zerzan. And one of the things... that really struck me about that you've written about, which is like one of these many, many historical episodes that it tends to be dismissed by the various elements of the left and the right and so many other folks in society. And I'm thinking specifically of the Luddite movement in the early 19th century in England, and also so many other movements that get characterized as utopian, that get dismissed as utopian. Like utopian is just a word to dismiss people with, right? Is that how it's generally used? And if you talk about that a bit, would you?
Well, the Luddite thing, that's another, to me, I think there is a Luddite sentiment afoot, and, you know, we've got to make it more real, certainly. But I mean, I remember in the mid-90s, I'm thinking of the Unabomber case, and I was surprised. I was amazed at how many people actually did that did resonate with people. For example, Alice once taught briefly at the business school here at the U of O, and she ran into a friend from there who's teaching at the business school, and there was the somewhat slightly iconic picture of Kaczynski being led out of the jail in Montana, and he's kind of looking up at the sky, and he's got these guards all around him. And she said, looking at that photo, why don't they just put a cross on his shoulders? And I was amazed. This guy is the mad, psychotic murderer of people and everything. And here's this business school professor saying, comparing him to Jesus. I mean, I don't want to make too much of that, but, you know, when things got starting to get interested in the 90s, I was noticing kids, well, let me put it this way. I refrained from reading Industrial Society and Its Future because I was afraid it might not be too good, and I didn't want to be disappointed. Anyway, people said, you haven't read it, read the damn thing. It's great. And, you know, and I think it is. But I used to run into anarchist kids here, and it was like, oh, we know all that. Yeah. Oh, really? Now, that's a damn hopeful thing.
Yeah.
We're ahead of the game. You know, it's out there, I mean, to some degree. And people are not happy with the technology. I mean, it looks like maybe people just have become zombies or in love with all these devices. Well, you know, they're not that happy. They're bored to tears. But yet, what else is there? You know, that's the age-old question.
Right.
What is that? What's the alternative? And the alternative is not too easy to bust out from that and just, you know, do away with all that. That's just a nice, tall order, you know, an enormous thing. So anyway, one has to count on that, I think, or at least I do, that it's, you know, the system is not having a totally untroubled sleep. They must know that the allegiance to all this shit is not very profound. It's not very well grounded. You know, it's not, I'm not saying it's going to blow away next week, but, you know, look at what's going on now, the anti-racism upsurge. It's wonderful. I mean, that just, some degree came out of nowhere. There's been racism forever, and yet, man, it's taken off and it's still going strong well over a month since the murder in Minneapolis, all over the place, not just the U.S., that's for sure.
Right. And it's like, I mean, it at the moment, as people are looking around themselves and seeing what's happening, it all seems like almost predetermined. But if you think about it, like with all the, for example, children being separated from their parents at the border and any number of other just horrendous atrocities being committed against large groups of people in this country, this upsurge that we're experiencing now could have happened in any number of other ways. I mean, the powder keg was a powder keg, but who knew what the spark was going to be? It could have been any number of things. Huh?
Yeah, it seems like it's always that way.
Yeah.
History wise. I mean, the biggest one that things to me, since I'm old enough, the 60s, mm-hmm. that came out of nowhere. I mean, it really did. There was a civil rights movement, you know, the freedom riders and so on, but there wasn't much else. It was just the happy conformist, over-consuming 50s right up until the middle of the 60s. And Marcuse wrote One Dimensional Man, 64. You know, he pretty much said, probably nothing is going to happen. People are just, they've been reduced to just almost nothing. Well, in a matter of months, he had to kind of take that back. He was overjoyed to take it back when things started going up all over the world. Of course, it didn't go far enough, but I mean, that was an incredible upsurge globally.
Yeah. And then people took to talking about the movement in a way that always struck me as when I was very young and I heard the term the movement. I mean, I was born in 67, so I wasn't really there in the 60s, but I was very much growing up in the shadow of the 60s and among older people who talked about the movement and without ever defining it. And it didn't seem to me need to be defined. It was just this this umbrella term for sort of actual resistance. Did you use the term the movement back then?
Oh yeah. You one served the movement. I mean, it took me a long time to dispense with that concept. You know, that's, you know, partakes of mass society all too much, of course, but you know, I was really formed in the 60s and yeah, the movement, I mean, it's just understood. It's all these things that have come together and this momentum that's going forward and gives people hope and things, you know, something's in the air. But
what do you think terms of the way that they used to use the term the movement? And I'm thinking of like also the way that the corporate media is trying to paint the movement that's happening now. And it seems to me like, I, you know, without wanting to dismiss at all the extremely important aspect of police brutality and institutional racism, the corporate media seems to be at every opportunity trying to make sure that we all frame what's going on in terms of an anti-racist movement, that's what this is, and that it's not something bigger than that. Because if it were even bigger than that and encompassed more than, you know, only racism, then it would be even more unmanageable and difficult to sort of contain. It's like my impression of where the editors are going with this, you know, because it never seems to be the journalists. I mean, most of the journalists don't seem to know what was going on yesterday. So I don't know.
I think you're quite right. That's there's that effort to confine it. I think we're seeing some movement outside of that, though. You know, probably you would agree. I mean, like, for example, the statuary that's targeted, it isn't just Confederate generals. You know, it's Columbus and George Washington. And, you know, in other words, that part of it is that it's suspending the focus, the understanding of what is oppressive. And, you know, it may well go further than that, you know, outside of those things. And I mentioned, you know, whose streets, no streets. That would be a nice next step, it seems to me.
It was only just a few months ago, I guess, Trump was saying, "Oh, if you're going to get rid of the Confederate statues, what's going to be next? George Washington?" And he said it with such a self-satisfied smugness, like as if there wouldn't ever be a widespread understanding of George Washington as a massively wealthy real estate speculating slave owner.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's I mean, one should never ask an intellectual to make any predictions, but do you have any feelings about where this might be heading? I mean, do you see, like, it seems like one of the things that's going on just in recent days or maybe even weeks is making these connections. Like, you hear a hell of a lot more if then statements. If Black Lives Matter, then what about housing? You know, if Black Lives Matter, what about redlining? What about the mass incarceration? You know, and there's obvious and less obvious connections to be made there, but a lot of them seem to be being made.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's as I say, I think it's always a surprise what's going to come. But I mentioned the city put in questions, you know, density. That's why you have a pandemic, most fundamentally. That's why you're supposed to stay at home to combat density. Well, that is sort of implies the city is the problem. That's density. That's the culture of cities. It's pretty much synonymous with civilization. And there are already all these people saying, oh, you gotta have cities. Well, why are they even troubled unless it is being questioned? So that gets pretty basic stuff. If we're gonna, and people are fleeing the cities, you know, because of pandemic conditions, and that could go further. I mean, that's really, it puts the whole damn thing at stake if we're really going to question urban life, you know.
It also really puts, I mean, in so many ways, it puts the whole capitalist economy in question too, right? With so much of it is based on real estate investment and speculation and rent gouging and selling houses at unbelievable prices and all this kind of manufactured scarcity. None of it needs to be that way. This one of the things you hear a lot is around this question of density, which strikes me as just one of the many ways that the rich and powerful tend to try to take reasonable arguments and turn them on their heads. Like when people talk about we need to house all of those people who don't have anywhere to live, and then the capitalists say, oh, well, we need to get rid of regulations more and have more housing, more density, more construction. What they never tell you is their goal is to create Houston everywhere. Like if anybody's been to Houston, you know you don't want to live in a city with no regulations, where it's all about construct anything you want as much as you want, and you know you end up with Houston. But this is their solution. It's more and denser,
right? And you can just cannibalize this and that when you have to. If malls are failing as widely as they say, Well, I've heard these plans for, well, we just turn it into housing. So we just move the markers around, and but it's still the same old game, that's for sure.
Somebody is wondering on watching on Periscope. They're wondering about what do you think of the corporations declaring their support of Black Lives Matter, and yeah, I have no idea. I'm not sure what they're talking about. The national organization's ties to the DNC, but and the DNC's effort to delegitimize the movement, but. Good talking points anyway. You got thoughts on corporations, the DNC, and Black Lives Matter and the intersection of the three?
People pointed out that capitalism is infinitely flexible. They'll turn anything into a commodity. One of my favorite examples was after anti-WTO in Seattle these years ago, I think it was Vogue approached a number of young anarchist women, black women, to try to market sort of punk anarchist clothing line. After people had put themselves on the line to go after it in Seattle, then just another, well, punk, they did that well before Seattle, but you know, it was just so brazen that they contacted these people, and they got a very unwelcome response, of course. But I mean, yeah, they just do anything. Yeah. That's just par for the course.
That upsurge in the late 90s with the global justice movement, or however, you know, it went by many different names, but that the whole protests around the WTO and the IMF and World Bank, and that was a hopeful period for you as well. I know you were doing a lot of, at least according to some things that I read that you said in interviews, you seemed to be feeling hopeful about where things were going, and you were doing a lot of traveling and speaking at that time. And then it seemed like, among other, there were so many different forces in the power structure trying to undermine that movement, but ultimately it seemed like 9/11 was the sort of nail in the coffin, but also put so much police brutality. I wonder what you think. What are your thoughts on that movement and the whole, also the whole idea of holding space, which was so much a part of it?
Well, it was generally called the anti-globalization movement, but sadly, it really wasn't very anti-globalization. The left liked ultra-globalization, just a watered-down progressive. In other words, they had no problem with globalization at all, really. And
it's sort of the fair trade versus free trade argument.
Yeah, basically. You know, on that level, I mean, that's, I recall the, I don't know where it was, Miami or somewhere, where typically the journalists would go up to some supposed anti-globalization protester and go, so why are you against globalization? And the response was almost always, oh, we're not against globalization. We're against corporate globalization, or we want the nice, warm and cuddly bottom-up globalization. Well, that's a position, but it's not anti-globalization. You know, and I would say you got to be a primitivist if you really are against the totalizing machine that's at work all over the globe. The movement of capital and technology that means that there's only one civilization now, in which it's so grandly failing. In other words, that was, we had, there were people that certainly raised the deeper questions about what is this globalization thing, but it wasn't. Despite the fact that there was so much energy, you know, at times, and starting with Seattle in 99, and then, as you say, going all the way up to 9/11, that was really the end of it, but that's a good 2 years worth, you know, right there. In Genoa, late July 2001, 300,000 people in the streets. And man, I wasn't there, but actually the Minister of the Interior in Italy blamed it on me, and I got some calls about that. I wasn't there. I had nothing to do with it. I mean,
I mean, there were like.
Yeah, but I mean, that was going strong just matter of weeks before 9/11. So, of course, various people said, do you think that was a coincidence? You know, 9/11 put paid. Mm-hmm. It was seemed to be getting stronger, certainly in some places. I mean, they were, you know, that was a pitched battle. I was there afterwards with an Italian friend, and he was showing me all of the, you know, the sites of the battle, and even the part where the World Social Forum, these Chomsky types, when the police drove the Black Bloc people into two parts and were trying to drive them down to the beach where the gated, relatively safe place was, it was the World Social Forum that barred the gates, that let them out to dry while the pigs attacked them. They let them in eventually, but, you know, that's just, well.
Yeah. And then the big protests in Genoa, the biggest days of protest at that time in Genoa, I was in Germany at the time, actually, playing at a climate summit in Bonn, and there were actually about half the people who were there left near the beginning, because this summit was going on. It started before the Genoa protests and ended after, and so there were about half the people who were there hijacked a train and went to Genoa, and then came back, many of them with broken bones and extremely traumatized. And they were saying that the biggest day of protest was actually in Genoa was actually locals protesting against the police because of the police brutality against so many people in the prior days around that the summit, which was interesting.
Yeah. Oh yeah, people at the basement of that church where people were attacked and, you know, and broken bones and people going to prison. That was insanely brutal.
Yeah. You know, so you have a lot of criticism of Noam Chomsky, which it seems like, you know, I don't know. It's people are afraid to talk about Noam Chomsky because it's too much of a big too much of an icon, I suppose. But you're very critical of his support for Joe Biden and this whole once again saying that the Republicans and Democrats both suck, but we should hold our nose and vote for Biden and this sort of thing. And I wonder if you have anything else to say on this whole concept of trying to move, like, save humanity one little tiny incremental step at a time by voting for the party that is slightly more wealthy than the other one, which is the Democrats.
Of course, that just reproduces and legitimates the whole damn system. Chomsky is a mild progressive. It's sad that anyone would confuse him with being an anarchist. That's pathetic. I mean, that's all there is to it. He's a mild progressive, and that's bullshit in my view. And you know something else here? You're probably not going to be too happy with this, but there's something I feel like I'm here under false pretenses if I don't bring this up. You might guess what I'm referring to. In 2010, you wrote a piece for a Trotskyist paper condemning Black Bloc militancy, saying they're the same as cops, they're doing the work of cops. I find that really objectionable. When people have the courage to risk injury in jail to go out there and go after, I mean, that's really, I'm hoping you don't feel that way now. I bet you don't say that about Black Bloc people that, you know, burn police cars and so forth.
Yeah, I have a lot of regrets about things that I wrote. I don't remember if that was 2010, but I think you're talking about something I wrote that was published in Common Dreams, maybe. I don't know. No. I think I wrote, I did. I was critical of Black Bloc tactics in Vancouver, BC, and I wrote something about that in 2010. Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. That was the equation for it. Anyway, I just felt like I needed to say something about that and just not pretend that. But again, I have no idea. I'm not saying you still think that or whatever, but just bring it up.
Yeah, good. But do you see any distinction between it seems to me that one of the things that's going on now with the, you know, what you could characterize as Black Bloc tactics being happening all over the country at the same time, as the press, the media, the pundits are constantly, well, especially Trump and his crowd, but many others are constantly talking about the outside agitators, and which is obviously the most preposterous thing you could say, because obviously how are you going to have outside agitators when they're coming from everywhere at the same time? But at the time that I wrote that piece, my feeling about it I'm not a pacifist, incidentally. My feeling about the tactics was not that I have any problem with the tactics per se. It's a question of whether it is building a movement or not, when it happens in the context of a one-off demonstration in one place where people are coming from all over the continent to go to that demo. And it seems to me that there's a distinction to be made, which whether I put it this way or not, but it seems to me that there's a distinction to be made between that and what's happening in more recently. I don't know if you see any distinction there in terms of, because it seems like there's a lot of people all over society who are much more sympathetic to the outrage and to the tactics now that they are more widespread.
Well, yeah, but you know, you never know. I mean, somebody who throws the first rock or whatever it is, that might go further. You can't just say, well, that was stupid and counterproductive because it didn't go anywhere. We don't know if it's going to go anywhere or not. I mean, somebody's got to step out of line first instead of just, you know, marching around with the police escort and having these parades, which never change anything. So, but it's always it's an open question. I think it's an open question as far as tactics. You know, sometimes one thing is much more appropriate than something else. You can't, certain times it's obvious you can't do certain things. It's just not going to work, you know. But, you know, there's often a chance that it's going to go further and, you know, bring on some nice surprises and nice outcomes. And because I said before, you know, I think it's always surprising what happens in history. And I mean, not always to the good. Mm-hmm. Obviously, but, you know.
What about the question of I mean, I'm asking this question because I want to know what you think. I don't have an answer to it personally, just to say. But what about the question of provocateurs? Like, I mean, and like you saw the video footage of the Minneapolis police popping the tires of people when they thought nobody was filming them or something. I don't know. Maybe they didn't think nobody was filming them, but it seemed like that didn't get out until some days after it happened. And I know that like people in Genoa were reporting how they saw that this is true at all the protests. And I've seen it myself, where so many people who are dressed as Black Bloc, who then are clearly undercover cops, because then you see them go behind the lines of the cops and hang out with them and take their masks off. And sometimes they're not at all they're not trying to hide the fact that they're cops.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying that doesn't exist. It's pretty much always there. I mean, that's just part of the arsenal of what you got to deal with when things get interesting. It's not going to be some clear cut, smooth sailing deal. You're always going to have to deal with different kinds of divisiveness and different kinds of authoritarianism. And if you don't, you know, if you've been through any of this kind of stuff, you see that it's just a given. But that doesn't mean that you never do anything for fear of provocateurs. And, you know, it's funny how that's such a lot of people agree with that. A lot of people retreat to this police provocateur stuff, you know, including all the people that don't want it to go anywhere and just look for excuses. That was true in Genoa. My friend was there and they were using that against the people who were fighting in the streets. Oh, that's just a bunch of, that was just put on by cops or something. Well, it's just a vicious lie very often. I'm not saying all, but you just have to go past that. It's like a lot of things.
You just have to assume, of course, this kind of thing is going to happen. There are going to be authorities trying to undermine.
Well, it'll be there. Property destruction, that's just so counterproductive. It's just going to turn everybody off. Well, it is going to turn people off. Some people off. You're going to get a hostile, defensive reaction. But I think you've got to go through that. You got to try to get past that. You can't just be stymied by what the reaction from people who are not used to seeing, you know, real resistance. They're not, and it's not. It's going to be no surprise that some of them will freak out, you know, touch my truck and I'll kill you. Kind of, you know, it's all kinds of crazy shit. But that doesn't mean that can be normalized pretty fast because you see right. that happening. It's some, you know, when things are going in the right direction, that you almost don't even remember that kind of stuff. You know, it's just it moves on to a different stage.
You know, I have to say that I agree with everything you're saying, John. And I also have to say that my own political evolution over the past 10 years, and I'd love to say that it's not, you know, so much based on my own personal experiences and that I had some kind of intellectual epiphany or something like that. But my own personal experience with living in, with getting priced out of one city after another and living in another city that I'm currently getting priced out of is really, it's been so illuminating to me. And actually the same kinds of tactics that I found unhelpful in the 90s now seem like now I wonder where is the Black Bloc? You know, I mean, I'm glad to see what's going on right now all over the country, but also I wish it weren't all mostly located in downtown cores, because the gentrification and the what's happening throughout society, the ethnic cleansing, the displacement of so many people, it is such a silent suffering that is happening for so many people. And then you do something as simple as put up a flyer on a telephone pole, and you can see how much hostility that you'll get for challenging the basic structure of, like, why is it that everybody is paying impossible amounts of money for housing? And, you know, it seems like smashing all the corporate stores would be a very good start towards lowering the cost of housing and actually more crime of you know, most any other sort, especially property destruction, would be very helpful in terms of countering where things are going. And I know it's like a bit late for me to come to this, you know, conclusion, you know, at the age of 53, but, and this has been going on for a very long time, but the division, the stratification of wealth in society is extremely extreme, like much more than it was when I was young. Yeah. I wonder what you have, any thoughts on that? I know I just said a bunch of stuff, but.
Yeah, that's, those of us that are more privileged just by being white, for example, I mean, you got to be aware of this. You it's because there's so much. It's just everywhere. That's but especially the people that are the most deprived and the most targeted, and in many ways, you know, it's just one tries to be aware of that. And you know, all of our ideas change. I mean, all of us have different notions and. And the realities are different. You know, it's just, I don't know what's going to happen next. You know, again, there's that question, where do we try to focus and how do we contribute? You know, it's, but yeah, that's, I'm glad you brought that up. It's very true.
What do you say to the accusation that the kinds of tactics that you're advocating are escalationist? What's your answer to that word?
I'm not familiar with that word, but
maximalist, or I don't know. But this idea, I was reading Galliani, this biography of Luigi Galliani, and it just seemed like basically, and I thought it was a brilliant book, and I thought he was an absolutely fascinating guy. But like it seemed like basically everywhere he went, he was. Basically trying to foment general strikes and being accused of fomenting general strikes. And then he had to leave because they were, you know, charging him with incitement to riot. And this was his entire life was basically doing that.
Well, I like that. Escalationist. Yeah. Let's up the ante.
Let's escalate.
Yeah. Again, the ideas aren't separate from the action. I mean, that's what drives the other. That's what gives some accessibility to certain ideas. I think that happened after Seattle, you know, to some degree. They wanted, the media, for example, wanted to know, why would people wreck downtown Seattle? Well, there were some of us who wanted to you know, reply to that. And we get a chance because there was damage in downtown Seattle. Otherwise, you know, 60 Minutes didn't come to my house for no reason. You know, in other words, you can call the tune to some degree. Or, for example, ALF or ELF communiques. People burn down the McDonald's. Well, then the same old question. Huh, why would people burn down a McDonald's if they haven't thought about it before? Well, here's the communique explaining why that happened, why that sort of thing is necessary. You know, then you might have a chance to go further.
When the French farmer, you know, what's his name? When he bulldozed the McDonald's, remember that? What's that?
Beauvais was his name, wasn't it?
Yeah. And he had huge support throughout French society for doing that, which struck me as interesting, like an interesting contrast to how ELF and ALF are activities are often sort of, I mean, to the extent that people know about them, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are sympathetic, and there's a lot of people who think, oh, that's just crazy, outrageous tactics. But Beauvais inspired a real different reaction. I don't know. Do you have any comments on that?
And we might not have guessed that that would be so resonant, but it was. Yeah, I recall that.
In Iceland, they blew up a dam. Farmers blew up a dam, and then they all in 1970, and then they all called into the police and said, "I blew up the dam." 113 farmers called in and said, "I blew up the dam."
Really?
And they never found who did it, and they never arrested anybody. And this is often credited as being the beginning of the Icelandic environmental movement. But it always struck me that when I heard about that story a few years ago for the first time, it struck me that the difference between what they did was and other incidents of blowing up dams was this idea of everybody calling in and taking credit for it in that particular very risky way that turned out to be a great gamble.
Nice. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, we're just a bunch of Luddites and, you know, we can't have that.
No. Well, John Zerzan, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for being on the show, and hope to talk to you again soon.
All right. Take care.
You too. And that has been thanks for tuning in to my discussion with John Zerzan for Fifth Estate Live, which you can hear every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and elsewhere. You'll find all of the Fifth Estate Live episodes at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the physical magazine or read the latest edition online. You can also find these interviews and my other interviews archived in various places in the Discussions with David playlist at youtube.com/drovix and in audio form at soundcloud.com/davidrovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, where you can also support my broadcasting efforts and check out lots of other content. Or if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. I was going to be interviewing Sherry Hankala of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union tomorrow, but she is currently in the hospital, so we had to postpone that one. So the next episode of Discussions with David will be on Thursday, when I'll take us to Philadelphia for another conversation with the very busy hip-hop artist and organizer Mike Africa Jr. Remember, don't pay the rent, and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. See you soon. Bye for now.